Well, welcome, Sasha. Yeah, very nice to see you. So we always start our interviews by just asking the poet about your choice of poem. So perhaps say something about the Blake first.
Yes, I chose the Blake because I did a very large project around Blake in Russia a few years ago. William Blake's pictures went to the Pushkin Museum in Moscow, and although he had been translated before into Russian, it was the first time that the Russians had seen his pictures as well as his poetry, and so there was it had a really huge impact, and I think it really changed how the Russians viewed William Blake, which was really wonderful. And one of the things that I did was I was involved in a translation of the book of Innocence and Experience, and with some Russian translators, and I was talking to them about all the poems, and a couple of them really stuck in my mind, and that was one of them. And it was really good to translate it, because translating is obviously such a fantastic way of studying a poem, that we found extraordinary spiritual depths in it, I suppose. That's how I chose Blake. But as a sort of principle, I chose Blake because he's such an independent writer, and he has such an unusual and unique position, and I admire that greatly, to be somebody who was not at all recognised in his own lifetime, and yet to keep going, and to keep going so assiduously, and with so little reflection, I think, on his own position, is an extraordinary, extraordinary thing.
And the Charles Causey, because that seems to relate to the Blake. I mean, he's obviously thinking of Blake, the Causey poem. I don't know Charles Causey at all. You know Charles Causey?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
I don't know him at all, yeah.
I can't recommend him enough. He's a wonderful writer, and he's as a 20th century writer who was he lived in Cornwall all his life. And perhaps some of you know Charles Causey. And I'm sorry if I'm telling you, things you already know, but he's I'm so full of enthusiasm for his work, because he was a very rooted poet. He lived in, I call it Launceston, but I think it's actually pronounced completely differently. How's it pronounced? Lanson. Fantastic, thank you very much. I spent my life reading it, and but I've never got there yet. And he went to sea in the Navy in the Second World War, so a lot of his poems are around marine ballads like this one. And he's got the most extraordinary poems about being at war and being on a ship and visiting all the different parts of the world. So he's an amazing poet, but he shares with Blake a complete independence of spirit, really. And again, somebody who just kept writing. I think he worked as a school teacher, and he wrote, and he never doubted. He just kept going, and I think that's a really extraordinary quality. So in a way, that's why I chose both the Blake and the Causey, because they both represent people who have such sort of strength of heart, really, that they don't think, they don't doubt, and something I admire very much.
When we were talking earlier on, you were saying that you might have chosen David Constantine, who came to poetry, so just be interested to hear why you were thinking of choosing David, because I'm very impressed by him myself. So.
David's somebody who has actually had a genuinely very profound influence on me, because he taught me, as an undergraduate, he taught me German and Russian, I studied German and Russian, and German poetry, and he found out at some point that I wrote poetry, and a friend of mine wrote poetry, and a few other people wrote poetry, and he agreed to give up his time and just do a poetry circle for us. I've taken an awful lot from that, because he's a very, very generous teacher, and an extraordinary poet, and I think his attention to the word and his feeling that, there is nothing more important, of being very influential in my own writing life. Although I think, and partly I didn't choose him tonight because I know he's been to read here and not that long ago, and I thought perhaps I would look at something slightly different. And partly also because I read his poetry now with extraordinary awe, because I think he's a magnificent poet, but I see that in some way, philosophically, I'm not quite doing the same thing as him, and so I suppose it was a kind of marker for me that I've done something slightly different.
So I want to start by sort of asking you more about your life first, and then talk about the books a bit more. I wonder whether you could just say, I was sort of asking, I'm always interested in this, in When did poetry and how did poetry enter your life? Reading it, writing it, how did it come about? If you mean?
I don't really know. It's a very good question, but I'm not sure. I've written poetry for a very long time, probably not seriously, but I wrote it as a child. But and I read a lot of poems as a child, probably learning poems and reading them in school, but nothing particularly radical. I do remember, though, the only thing I've ever stolen, I have to admit to this now, is a poetry book which I stole from school because I loved it so much. And at the end of the term, we had to hand them back in. And it was a very old-fashioned one called A Choice of Poets, with a selection of, you know, various poets, including Edward Thomas and D.H. Lawrence and, you know, a whole range of different poets. And I loved it so much that I said I'd lost it, and I kept hold of it. And I've still got it on my shelf.
So. Were your family interested in poetry, or...?
No, not particularly, no. In fact, I remember my father once asking me to define poetry, and I started saying, well... And I looked at him, he'd fallen asleep.
one of the things I wanted to ask about, obviously, is your Russian connection. The Estate, your volume, The Estate, starts with this wonderful sequence of poems about Pushkin, and set in. I know you stayed in his estate, and you've lived in Russia for 5 years. So I'd be interested to hear how. You know, not only how poetry entered your life, but how Russia entered your life, sort of thing. And presumably the Russian language and so on.
Yes, again, it's slightly hazy for me. I started teaching myself Russian when I was at school, and then I met through a teacher at school. I met a woman in Brighton who was extraordinary. She'd left Russia in the revolution, and she'd come to Britain via some incredibly circuitous route around Europe. And... she was just extraordinary, and she lived in a little flat very close to my school in Brighton, and on the outside it was an ordinary block of flats, and then inside it was like Alice in Wonderland. It was Russia, and the samovar, and, you know, Russian pictures and a Russian divan, and we read Chekhov together on Friday afternoons.
As you do.
And she used to make me a lemon tea. She was very elderly by then, and so I did that. Then I went to Russia, and then I studied Russian, and then went back to Russia and spent quite a lot of time to-ing and fro-ing. Yes, it's always been part of my life, and I can't honestly tell you quite why.
And you just started teaching yourself Russian?
Yes.
Why in Russian?
I don't know.
How old were you when you started teaching yourself?
I was about 10 or 11.
Anybody else teaching themselves Russian? 10?
10 or 11. Very, very much.
It's quite unusual, isn't it?
I really did feel very drawn to Russia, and I went on a school trip, and I remember... then we had an Interis guide, you know, one of these incredibly, they were very sort of, then, when I went in the 80s, they were very, they'd been chosen put for their political allegiances and so on to go around with Western school groups, and this man was kind of completely sort of inscrutable. And I remember that I used to drive him wild because I used to go up to him and pester him with questions in Russian that I'd learnt. I had no idea what I was saying, of course. So
What was I thinking? I lost my track of thought. So you started learning Russian then. I slightly wonder whether it was to do with your name, because when I first heard your name, I assume that Sasha sounds like a Russian name.
Just a coincidence.
Is it?
Yes,
oh, that's right.
Could be coincidence.
It's not that your parents are particularly interested in all things Russian.
No, I don't think so.
And what about theatre? Because, you know, obviously you've translated Neighbourhood's Praise, you talk about Chekhov. Can you say something about theatre and Russian theatre particularly, and your whole involvement in that?
Well, I was working for the British Council, and I was the arts officer in Moscow, so I was doing a lot of theatre work, and, you know, theatres were coming out from Russia, and I was with them, and I was going back to see British theatre companies and talk to them about coming to Russia, so there was a lot of theatre in my life generally, and I've always been quite an avid theatre goer, so that really, really suited me. And then we started a project called the New Writing Project with a lot of young Russian playwrights, and there simply weren't any translations of their work, so I said, well, I'd better do a few, so there's something to work with. And so that's how it started, really. I translated a few who plays, and then found I had a real appetite for it, and I really enjoyed it. And and it was also a sort of urgency, really, because there was nobody doing that sort of work then. There was nobody who was that interested in new Russian writing in Russia, and certainly not outside Russia. So there was a complete, there was just a vacuum. So there was everything to translate.
Yeah.
And that's how I started working on the project. And then when I came back to Britain, I carried on working for the Royal Court, because really, really, practically speaking, it was the same situation here. There was no one around who would translate Russian drama, and I just happened to be there and happy to do it.
And what was it like working with the Royal Court? Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I like the Royal Court a lot, and I like doing the Russian drama. It was always quite odd, because most of the Russian drama was very was a real reaction to classical Soviet drama, so it was all completely obscene and sort of highly pornographic, and you know, and it had all sorts of awful things happening in it, and mostly it was just you know, kind of its obscenities. And so I'd sit in my house with this, you know, play in front of me, trying to translate and working out how to say certain things in English, and I'd ring around all my friends and I'd say, I've got this phrase here and I just wondered how you'd say it in English. So it was odd. It was like translation from one language sort of through English and into another language.
Moving on to your work, you know, obviously Russia and Russian poetry has affected you very much, your work. In the Guardian Review, Paul Batcher says it's a bit like sort of Edward Thomas in a conversation with Marina... The fact that there's this sort of meeting between sort of English, and it's sort of English romantic or in a pastoral sense, with sort of Russian and European poetry. Would you agree with that? Is that your sense of your...
So, interesting. I don't honestly know, and it's very hard for me to judge. The only thing I can say is that what I was very impressed by in Russia and in Russian poetry circles and going to Russian poetry readings was, again, well, a bit like David Constantine, it was incredibly serious. It wasn't, there was no sense that it was something that you might do as a hobby. It was a deadly serious activity, and you devoted your life to it. And there's something quite inspiring about being with people who think that poetry is worth that much. And so I suppose, even if I didn't take a lot of... I can't say I was highly influenced by any of the Russian poets, but I do think that seriousness is something really valuable. And perhaps in British poetry, which maybe at times... You know, if the great fault of Russian poetry is that it can spiral off into abstraction and sort of, you know, at its worst, into stuff which just is abstract kind of nonsense. Mm. The fault of British poetry, it seems to me, is that it does the opposite. It almost, it's very happy to drop down into the everyday and sort of description of the everyday. So whilst, you know, that's quite it's quite a nice influence to have, that simply that seriousness, I suppose.
Mm. Yes, indeed. And then you translated Elena Schwarz's poetry. Were you particularly drawn to her poems, or, you know, was she an important figure for you?
Yeah, she was very important for me.
I don't know her as a poet at all.
She's a very powerful poet. And after I did my degree, I was planning to do a PhD in Elena Schwarz and Joseph Brodsky. And I didn't get any funding. And I got a job in Russia instead. So I took the job. And I'm glad I did. But I always felt that I had some unfinished business and that I had to come back. So I did translations of Elena Schwarz, and probably that was a much better thing to do, because, you know, again, translation is such an act of homage that you know, it was almost a better way to have that relationship with Elena Schwarz. And in fact, I finished her work, and she was supposed to come over to Aldeburgh a couple of years ago, and she rang me up and said she'd been having some stomach cramps and she couldn't come, and she died of cancer very shortly after that. So it was very, very sad. I almost met her more times than I can tell you, and never managed quite to meet her, but translated her, and always felt we had great closeness, because when we talked about her poems on the internet or, you know, by phone, it was always wonderful to talk to her, because she was so full of, she was a very quick, alive person. So I was very sad not to actually properly meet her.
And what draws you to translation generally? Because it's renowned as being a thankless Tom's translation. I mean, in the old days, they didn't even sort of acknowledge the translator. They just, you know. What draws you to translation particularly?
Well, originally...
It's hard work, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, originally it was a duty because there was so much new writing and also in Russian new poetry that was coming through and wasn't being translated at all by anyone, or if it was being translated, it was translated by people who weren't necessarily that bothered. They just wanted to get a translation out there. They weren't going to spend hours fiddling with every line. And that, I mean, that has its place too. I think that's, you know... But so there was a sense that there was an awful lot of work that needed to make its way into English so that more people could read it.
Mm.
And I don't know... And I love translating. I love the sense that you're... And there's a really great thing... You know, when Keats talks about negative capability in writing, and I've always been really struck by that idea of somehow undoing yourself in order to admit something great. So he talks about Shakespeare having negative capability.
Mm.
So the sense that you can undo yourself in order to enter into somebody else, and I like that so much, and I thought that was a wonderful way to describe translation, which is quite a sort of It's quite a sort of meditation in its own way, because you do actually sort of undo yourself completely in order to climb into something that belongs to somebody else and find it again in English. So it's a very interesting thing to do that way.
So moving on a bit more to the work. I wanted to ask you a few questions, but quite a few, I've got lots of questions. One of the things that struck me, for instance, is the use of form in the books. So, you know, reading both Red House and The Estate, there seems to be, there's firstly a real interest in form, it seems to me. There's a lot of sonnets. You seem to be particularly drawn to sonnet form, I thought. You use quite a lot of rhyme, even full rhyme, which is quite unfashionable now. But there's also quite a lot of experimentation, I felt. You're sort of quite particular use or not use of punctuation, for instance, or poems without titles. And so it feels to me there's this tension in the work between an honouring of the great tradition of form and a desire to experiment. I don't know whether that's how you feel about it, but I wonder whether you say something about you and form and experimentation.
Yes, it's hard, because again, that is something that comes from Russian, of course. Until now, and even now, most poetry in Russian is written in formal metre and rhymes. I think there's some crazy statistic, like 3% of Russian poetry is written in free verse. Mm-hmm. So it's completely the opposite of the way the current here, I suppose. And I've talked a lot to Russian friends, and I don't think this is why I do it, but it's certainly something that's interesting for me to talk about. And one of my friends, particularly Grisha Krushkov, who's a very brilliant translator of poetry, particularly Irish poetry, and Yeats and Heaney, and he was talking about how rhyme is magic, because when you start a rhyme, it's like a magic spell, and you have to find a rhyme, and that what you find to rhyme with that word will take you off in a direction that you'd never sensed was in the poem. And I've always really liked that idea, that the poem would take itself off on a walk, I suppose, and through the rhyme. And I also feel sometimes that in Russia people learn poetry and they learn translations of poems, and they know, for example, you know, many Russian people can quote Burns or anything Keats and Wordsworth in Russian translation, and it's very widely done. People know poetry; they know it off by heart.
Mm.
And I don't think we do in the same way. And I suppose partly it's because it hasn't got that completely. That's sort of completely under musical underpinning, I suppose. And the experimentation is mostly in punctuation, and it's interesting. I don't know. I'm glad you said that, because it's a sort of interesting thing for me to reflect on. The punctuation is very, very definite. Because whenever I spoke to my editor about it, and she said, well, there's no full stop there.
Yes.
Is that how you want it? And I go back to it, and I look at it, and I put a full stop in, look at it for a while, and then I put it out again. It has to be as it is. And it's peculiar, actually, because I think sometimes it does look as if I've just left it off. But it's...
No, it feels very conscious when I've read it, hadn't it? What it did for me in reading it was it meant I needed to be on my toes more when I read it. You know, how to read it. It creates a slightly different relationship to the poem, I thought, anyway. I don't know whether that's what you had in mind. But.
Well, it might be partly because that's when I'm writing it, that's also how I feel. It's not letting me, the poem isn't letting me come to a definite conclusion sometimes. Mm. Yes.
For instance, Red House, it doesn't have a full stop at the end, does it? The book, I was very struck by the last sentence. And it shouldn't have a full stop, but I'll come back to the last sentence. But it sort of shouldn't have a full stop, shouldn't it? That struck me, and it sort of chimed back through all the punctuation in a certain sort of way. Keeping to Russia for a minute, I am very fascinated because I don't know anything about Russia and I've never been there. I was very struck by your sequence, The Estate, in The Estate, which starts The Estate, your 2007 collection. It's written, it's about a popular legend about Pushkin. I wonder whether you say a little bit about it. It's such an interesting legend, and I was very struck by the sequence, whether you might just say something about that.
Yeah, well, I was going to Russia quite a bit to do seminars on translation, and we were translating British poetry and British plays in a place called Mikhailovka, which is Pushkin's estate, where his family and his ancestors came, lived, and it's the estate they owned. And it became a Russian... It's a really fascinating thing, actually. It's one of those extraordinary places. Pushkin is the kind of literary saint of Russia, patron saint of Russia in literature, and he's incredibly important to Russians. And most Russians know a lot of his poems and, So there's no real equivalent, I don't think, in Britain. But the estate Mikhailovka, after the Second World War, that whole area had been occupied by the Germans and been completely destroyed, really. And there was a very, very visionary man who took over the estate and decided that he was going to make it this museum place to Pushkin and to Russia. And with the most incredible... I mean, there was nothing there then. It was just... Russia was destroyed. People were dying of hunger, and yet he managed to put together this wonderful... sort of reservation, really, round it. I mean, to the extent that... I mean, it's enormous. It's many miles squared. To the extent that there's a railway embankment that stretches right the way across, that originally had a railway line on it. And this man who took over the estate agreed with the government that they wouldn't replace this railway line. They'd leave the railway line out because it was going through this special reservation where Pushkin had grown up. Mm. And so it's an amazing place. And even when Russia was falling apart in the 1990s, it was one of the few places that was kept absolutely immaculate. So all round the house where Pushkin lived, the drives were swept and the bins were emptied and the flower beds were, restocked. And the 90s were a very difficult time in Russia, and a lot of Russia looked very drab and was really suffering. But Mikhailovka was a sort of place apart, some sort of mythical place. And it's enormous. And if you go there, there's Pushkin's house and his various relatives' houses and a mill that he's supposed to have based one of his poems on. And amazing place. And it's also a very sacred place because it's so untouched and so quiet. And I really see an opening for the London Buddhist Centre, which is a Russian retreat. It's fantastic. If you go in the summer, you can hear cuckoos at midnight. And bears and wolves. And
let's keep on thinking the bears, actually.
and hares. And there's a story that Pushkin, who was exiled there in the 1820s, do I mean that? I can never remember the dates. So, 1820s, I think. Anyway, whenever the Decemberist uprising was in Russia, when a few people stormed the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg and demanding a constitution, and the people who led this uprising were all executed or sent into exile in Siberia. And Pushkin wasn't there, although many of his friends were amongst those who were executed and exiled. And the reason he wasn't there was that he was actually already exiled. He'd been exiled to Mikhailovka, which is a sort of very gentle exile. Mm. And his father had, interceded on his behalf with the Tsar and promised to spy on Pushkin if he went to Mikhailovka. So he lived in this very uncomfortable relationship with his father, who was supposed to be spying on him. He was out in Mikhailovka. And he set off for St. Petersburg, and there's this legend that as he set off to meet all his friends, a hare ran across his path. And in Russian superstition, folklore, that a hare running across your path is very bad luck. So he turned around and went home. And if he'd joined his friends, then he would have been involved in the uprising and probably executed or exiled. So that's the basis of that sequence about Pushkin in Mikhailovka.
Again, it starts with a sonnet, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Beautiful sonnet from the hare's point of view. Going on a bit more, I wanted to ask you something about some of the themes in the book. The first theme that really struck me, actually, is the theme of war in the books, but in both books. In The Estate, for instance, there's a terrifying poem called The Conscript, which, you know, really frightened me. It's a terrifying, very, very frightening poem about someone being beaten up in an army barracks. There's a poem, Annunciation, in Red House, about Irene Sendler rescuing children from the Warsaw Ghetto. Through both collections, there feels like there's a threat, quite a lot, isn't there? There's a threat. One of the threats is of war. I wonder whether you think that's right, and whether that's a theme that's there in the work.
Yes, it is there. It's partly, again, because of Russia, although it's not directly Russia. I think it's more the sense that living in Russia at a period when it was at war with in various places, and, you know, particularly the Caucasus, where Russia was basically fighting in the Caucasus the whole time I was in Russia. And so I suppose that's always there. And I think the other thing about being in Russia in the 1990s was that for there was a freedom, suddenly freedom of expression, you know, after perestroika. And a lot of... And what happened, I think, was a lot of people went back to the Second World War, or the Great Patriotic War, as it's known in Russia, and started talking about it freely and openly. And so some of that, I think, has found its way into the poems. That's and the Warsaw Ghetto poem about Irina Zandler was actually some Russians I knew who were talking about her.
Oh, really? You might say something about her, I didn't forget, but I don't know.
She was a woman who was actually nominated for a Nobel Prize at some point, but she rescued children from the Warsaw Ghetto. She pretended to be a plumber or to be inspecting sanitation and took her plumbing kit with her and rescued children from their parents, who were bound to die, so the parents had to give up their children in the hope that they would be saved. Mm. And she rescued, really, an awful lot of children, and then... and these orphans mostly survived, but she was caught. She survived too, and she was caught and tortured. But she did actually. I think she got to the end of the war and didn't die. Didn't die in the Second World War. I'm just trying to think whichever. Yes, the poem about. This conscripts was a Russian thing, that the Soviet army is formed of so many different nationalities, and everybody's conscripted at a certain age, unless they can find a good reason not to be conscripted, which people spend an awful lot of money doing. There's a lot of, and it's just a lot of tension really in the army, and so I think that was a poem about something that somebody told me about their barracks, that they'd beaten up one particular soldier. And it is basically as it happens in the poem.
It is very terrifying, isn't it? I was very struck by it. I mean, generally, I felt that in the... I will come up with positive things in a minute, but I don't want to frighten everybody. But I was struck by feeling that of also that the possibility of human viciousness, in not just war, but also to human viciousness. So there's, in Meldrum, which starts Red House, there's a line that says, "When the sun rises, it will seem to our ancestors that a new race has come out of the sea, dripping with gold, crueler than the last." And that, again, that feels like a theme that runs through the book. is the possibility of cruelty, the threat of it, placed against very often, in the poem on beauty, placed against the beauty of children, for instance. There's another in Red House Secrets. There's the fear of rape. There's all kinds of sort of. There's a lot of threat in work in the poem. I don't know whether that's something you want to talk about more, but I was very struck by it.
It's interesting. I did a reading in Gosport a couple of years ago. When I got to the end, a woman at the front said, "See, the thing is, there's not much comedy in your poems." So I'm just warning you. it's interesting. I think that's actually the point where I diverge from David, and I mean in a completely sort of literary or poetic way, because I absolutely share his ideas about poetry itself. But I think that for David, when I read his poems, I get the sense that if we just do the right thing and we sort ourselves out, then everything might be all right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very there's something very reassuring about his poetry. If we just, you know, find that bit of love and find that bit of that thing that's right, then we will come through.
Mm.
And I think that. I don't know if it's because I'm part of a different generation, and I think that might be something to do with it.
Probably,
But I don't necessarily feel that way. I don't think I'm hopeless in the least, but I don't think that, you know, if we just find those, if we just get everything into its right place, things will be all right. And I don't, I think it might be a generational thing, actually. It's probably more interesting. I don't know.
I mean, obviously there's very positive, because it is set against very positive things. So there's a real celebration of nature in particularly in the Red House. That I'm thinking the wonderful poem Dawn Chorus and Laughter. There's a real kind of celebration of nature. There's even at times a fear about that, because there's in the poem Ten Moons you talk about, so that, you know, there's this imagination that these moons means that the wrecking can continue 24 hours a day, which is, again, a terrifying image, because you expect a poem about moons to be very positive, and suddenly what looks to be a romantic image turns into a slightly terrifying one. Anyway, I wasn't going to talk about that, but there is a lot of rejoicing in nature, isn't there? There's a lot of feeling for nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's stick with that side of it for a moment, shall we? Would you agree? Isn't nature something that's important? You know, there's a feeling for the natural world in the poems very much.
Yeah, I think it is quite important to me, and it is a good counterbalance to everything else, because I think there's something quite inherently safe in the cycles of nature, which, you know, and it's a literary commonplace, really, and I don't mean that in a bad way, because I hope it will always be a literary commonplace. That, you know, how often do you read about terrible things that have happened, and then as they come to their close, you know, the birds start singing, for example, or you suddenly notice that actually it's not long till the trees come into bud, and somehow there's something very safe about the natural cycle.
Although you turn that on its head, don't you? Because there's one poem that I can't remember which it starts with, where spring trusses winter.
Oh, yes. You know, oh,
but okay, let's move on. The other theme that struck me is that the theme of motherhood and children generally. There's a wonderful poem in the estate called Motherhood, which I found very, very moving. And there's Wolstonbury in Red House, and something like Fish's Dream. There's a lot of feeling about children. You've got children of your own. Can you tell something about children in poetry for you?
Yeah.
And motherhood.
I probably haven't written that many poems about motherhood, but I noticed somebody very cleverly wrote recently that you probably don't get too many poems about birth and early motherhood because you're too knackered to actually pen and write about
right.
it. So, yeah, you're kind of mostly looking back on it, I think, which is maybe slightly misleading. But difficult to know what to say, really. I haven't written as much as I should have written about my children, but I suppose that's partly because I suppose we're writing, I find that poems, again, I think it's something to do with this thing about everything was going to be all right. I found very straight kind of praise poems or poems that are about something that's absolutely wonderful, extremely hard to write. Mm. They somehow, they get stuck in my throat. That makes me sound like a really twisted person. Somehow you feel as if, you know, so many other poets have done that so beautifully and so wonderfully that as soon as you start looking at something that's extraordinary, you immediately turn to those poets and start thinking about their poems. Mm. So,
that's true, yeah. And what about... I wanted to ask you just a little bit about the sequence Red House. It's again a series of seven sonnets. Again, it feels a very ambitious sequence to me. It's both mysterious, it's unsettling, it brings in history, it brings in the threat of violence. I'm struck by the echoes of the King James Bible in it. Can you say something about the creation? Because, you know, the first line and the last line is "the Red House lies without the parish of the soul." Very unusual first line for a contemporary poet to be writing. And the whole sequence is a very haunting, unusual sequence. I wonder if you could just say something about that sequence.
Well, it wasn't written, how can I put this? Some of the poems I've written have been started, I suppose, by looking at pieces of art. That was one of those. So I saw a wonderful picture by Peter Doig called The Red House, and I started just thinking about that. And so the poem is not at all about that piece of work, because it's very indistinct in my mind, but it's certainly, looking at that picture started off a whole circle of thoughts. Mm. And I'll read some of those poems. It's a sort of, I think it's called a crown of sonnets, so it's a series of sonnets the first and the last line are the same. But... beyond that, I can't honestly tell you what it's exactly about, because part of me thinks that it's about writing generally, and some of it is a lot of it is taken from things that I've seen or heard from people, various memories that people have given me.
Mm. Anyway, it's interesting that, because I was very struck, I thought, I don't know how you pronounce it, Angora, which is a major poem in the collection. I was very struck by your sympathy for the people that you're writing with, a real sense of you inhabiting their world and seeing it from their point of view. So it's interesting that quite a lot of things that you write seem to be also to do with what you've heard from others and what your relationship with others.
Yeah. That's probably, yes, I think that's really true. I think that might be something to do with the translation and the, it's always quite a good way to get into a poem. I don't know, possibly any form of art is by entering in through another's voice, because it gives you a freedom that you don't have when you start writing from your own voice. And it gives you a freedom to express the things that you want to say, but somehow if you do it from an oblique angle, then it frees up an awful lot of other stuff.
And finally, we better finish, but finally, just ask. I'd like to ask you about the religious feeling about the poems, the sense of sort of spiritual questing in the poems. There's a point in The Red House, in the sequence we're just talking about, where you say there is no addressing the Lord, for we are plain beyond that. But isn't that white round a hole in the sky where he once sat? So I was very struck by that, and again, these... Throughout the poem, like the whole collection finishes with "Your love is a walled garden, and yet there will be no name that can contain it," without a full stop. So I'm wondering about the spiritual aspect. There seems to be, to me, a spiritual yearning in the poems, and a sense of the absence of God from reading them.
Yeah, I think that's probably. That's very true, and probably. Something to do with... I mean, I was brought up a Catholic, although not a particularly... We went to church, but I wouldn't have said we were wildly devout, but certainly there's that kind of Irish Catholicism around that is very very cultural, really, and all about all sorts of other things apart from going to church, and going to church is one of them. But I don't believe, and so for a lot of my... childhood seems to be a series of little rituals which it's quite a hard thing to explain for me. Mm. I don't know if it's something that's particular to deeply cultural religions, or if it's something that I don't know. I mean, I'd be really interested to hear about your experiences, actually, because it's not something that I've ever managed to work out.
Mm.
But yes, certainly. I didn't go to church after when I was a teenager, but I did try and go back when I was at university, and lasted a very short time, really.
And just to finish, have you got another collection coming out? I know it's fairly recently since The Red House came out. But
no, I'm working on some poems at the moment. And so I was saying earlier, I'm working on some long poems, which is something that I haven't done before. And it's really fun to do, because it's a different pace. And I suppose it's the difference between a sprint and a marathon, really. It's odd, because you can't write from inspiration if you're writing a long poem, because you just couldn't keep it up. So there's some different paying out of energy, which is... It's fun to try and explore and see what happens. So I've just been writing about that. I've started writing a series about a sort of long poem about two twin brothers, princes, and their father sets them to sail along the Seine, and they float down the River Seine in France, and it's such a sort of brilliant scene. I think it was a picture that was painted, and it's in the art gallery in Rouen. I saw the picture, so I thought I'd write something about that. And it's been great to do, actually. It's been a sort of wonderful thing to do, but that's about it, really, I'm afraid.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very nice to speak to you.